are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Due to Sullivan's extensive writing about Ted Bundy, which has produced 6 books, he's become a sort of magnet over the years, drawing out many people who were part of the Bundy story, but have otherwise kept a low profile over the decades. And these first-person contacts continue to this day. As such, this is the first book in a new series of books whose aim is to bring new revelations to the public about Bundy, the victims, the murders, and the almost murders that failed Bundy for one reason or another. This first offering, Ted Bundy, the Yearly Journal, Volume 1, contains a great deal of never-before-published information from a number of women who barely escaped his grasp. It also reveals Bundy's geographic hunting pattern after his arrival in Salt Lake City, Utah, in September 1974. A surprising discovery the author never expected to make, but did, and it all came about through the valid testimonies of the women who encountered him during this period. The book also delves into what the author believes is perhaps an accurate, albeit conservative, estimate of how many women or young girls Bundy approached but failed to abduct during his years of murder. Each new volume will focus on particular aspects of the case where further investigation is warranted. There are still unknowns out there, and as the author has experienced, where unknowns exist, the possibility of discovery awaits. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal, with my special guest, journalist and author, Kevin M. Sullivan. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Kevin M. Sullivan.
Well, thank you, Dan. We always have a good time when we are together on your show, and the same will be today with this 7th book, or the first book in a new series on Ted Bundy. Lots of new info there.
Absolutely. This is highly anticipated. As usual, everyone can't get enough of information about Ted Bundy because there's so much more, as you say, so much more to uncover, as you are a testament with this, as you say, 7th book about Bundy now. Let's talk about right away in the very beginning, you talk about that you were fortunate enough with your very first book. Let's talk about how this 7th book came about by talking about the first book, The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History. And you say you were happy, or you were fortunate enough to work with many of the people involved in the case, including the top investigators, Jerry Thompson from Salt Lake City, Utah, Michael J. Fisher, the Colorado investigator, Russ Renault and Randy Everett, Idaho investigators, Robert D. Keppel, the Washington State investigators, and Ira Beale, bountiful Utah detective who worked the Carol DeRange case, and Don Patchen, the first detective for the Tallahassee Police Department in the Florida Chi Omega murders, and Bill Hagmeier, the retired FBI agent from the BSU unit who became very close to Bundy during the last years and spent as many as 200 hours interviewing Bundy before his execution. It would be from these sources and in-depth interviews that followed that new and never before published information surfaced about several of the murders, along with new general information about the case. From that decision sprang 5 additional companion volumes. Tell us about the 5 companion volumes following the Bundy murders and when they were released.
Yeah. Sure. Well, you know, I considered my work on Bundy would be one and done with the Bundy murders, A Comprehensive History. I mean, that's the full biography. That was the full treatment of the murders. It was a long book to write. It was 2.5 years dealing with a lot of sources from a lot of different states. And thank God I was able to come up with a lot of new information that had never been published before in any of the other books. And several factors of that information was new information about the murders that were verifiable and told to me by the detectives. So I was, you know, it turned out to be a great decision for me to delve into Bundy and write that book. But it came out in 2009, and I was done with Bundy, except for, you know, doing podcasts or whatever, or, you know, maybe writing an article or a blog. But I didn't really want to write another book about Bundy. But in 2015, one of my close contacts with Bundy had passed away, and that was Lorraine Fargo. I never got to interview Lorraine for the Bundy murders, but we became friends afterwards when she contacted me, and I write about Lorraine in the Bundy murders. And in fact, it was in that book that I don't like to speculate about things, but I had a couple things about Bundy and the night that he abducted Kathy Parks. There was a couple things that I speculated about that might have happened. And when I talked to Lorraine, after she contacted me a year after my book, The Bundy Murders, was published, she was able to confirm that. But anyway, but she passed away. I hated to see her go, but she was gone. And another of my contact, I can say it at the time, it was Jerry Thompson. He had been entering into a state of dementia for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I talked to Jerry, I could see that. And I said, I got to thinking about it and I thought, well, you know, if I'm ever going to write a companion volume, that really I thought it would be the companion volume and then that would be done. I said, well, maybe I should do it now. And so I went out west. I retraced my steps. I went to some new places that I couldn't get to when I was researching the Bundy murders. And lo and behold, I was finding out a lot of new information about the case that sure did add to my previous book. And it kind of like expanded it. And that's what these volumes will do. And so anyway, that book came out in 2016 called The Trail of Ted Bundy. Well, by this time, a lot of people already knew me from the Bundy murders. That book has been a good steady seller ever since it came out. And then when I'm on a documentary or something, the sales will really shoot up and then they'll stay that way for a while and go back down. But it's always been a good seller. So I know people were getting my book and reading it. So that, along with podcasts I would do, along with television interviews I would do, that I became kind of like a magnet for people who carried these Bundy stories, but had never really talked about it. It was the same thing with Lorraine. She said she avoided Bundy. She avoided the talk of it. And I was the first person she ever contacted who had written about Bundy. And she said, it's time for me. I think it can be like a catharsis for me to read your book and to talk about it. And then later, one of Lorraine's friends and a woman that lived in Sackett Hall with Kathy Parks as well, she contacted me and she said, I've lived with this for years. I think I want to just, I have heard that you write the book in the right way. You're not sensational in your writing. You talk about the victims a lot. So I'm going to read your book. She did, and it helped her. But the bottom line is a lot of people started contacting me who had experiences with Bundy and a run-in with Bundy. Now, there were people that contacted me that didn't because Bundy wasn't in the geographical area that they were in at the time, or there were certain things that they said that were strong red flags to me. But on the ones that I ended up putting in my companion volumes, they just didn't have any red flags. And you can sure tell when somebody is telling the truth and somebody is not. Some of these people that were trying to foster these fake images of running into Bundy, they'd have these elaborate stories. But others would have, well, I ran into him. He was driving this beige VW. He seemed like a really nice guy. He wanted me to go with him in the car. It was a sunny day. But I just didn't want to. And then I never thought about it again until his face started hitting the news and the papers. And I thought, well, wow, that's the guy I ran into. Basically, a nothing story. But what makes it something is that they really ran into him, which over time can tell you things about Bundy and in particular, his hunting pattern. When he got, and we'll talk about that a lot more because a lot of information came out about his hunting pattern. And it not only showed where Bundy was that first month he was in Utah hunting for women, but it also puts to death, in my opinion, a myth that's been around for a long time, a myth that I didn't even mention in the Bundy murders because I never really believed, but I expanded it a little bit and talked about it in The Trail of Ted Bundy. But anyway, so all these people kept coming to me and my files, you know, would get inundated with information here and there, testimonies here and there. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should write a third book because I've got these testimonies and I can go out and get more testimonies and find people that, for instance, like I mentioned in the Bundy murders, but I never interviewed. And so the third companion volume came out, and I swear people laugh about this. And really, I do too. Each time I put a companion volume out, like the third one was The Bundy Secrets. In that book, I presented I have these new testimonies, but I also presented certain parts of the record that I have always found so interesting with commentary and like backstory from me. So that came out. And every time I put out a companion volume, I thought, well, good, this is going to be the last one.
Right.
And so it just went on and on. And then of course, you know, then the fourth book was Ted Bundy's murders, mysteries. And again, people have contacted me with these really interesting stories. And it's funny because when I just, every time a book is published, I like to take about a week off and don't do anything except do podcasts or whatever, or maybe radio interviews. And I go, the book's been released. I watch how it's doing. I just kind of relax a little bit. And so as soon as Ted Bundy's Murders Mysteries came out, I think that was in 2017, I had a guy contact me, Facebook friend by Michael Ryan. His name is Michael Reinhardt. And Michael said to me, he said, have you ever thought about doing an encyclopedia of like the Bundy murders? And I said, no, I never have. But do you realize that just 2 days ago, they just released a book of mine on Bundy? And he said, yeah. I said, I can't get into that right now. I said, you know, it kind of sounds kind of good. But at the same time, man, I can't even think about that. He said, well, let's put it on the shelf for now. He said, I would do it myself, but I'm doing similar things with pertaining to the American Civil War. And I said, he said, I just don't have time for it. So after a couple of days, I contacted my publisher. I ran it past them. I thought, well, they might say, well, we're really not interested in that. And I say, okay, fine. But they said, no, we think it's a great idea. You should do it. So I did it. And it was a fun experience because I got to talk to some newspaper reporters and dig out information on them who were writing about these women that were disappearing then. It was an interesting book to write. And once it was published, I thought, wow, it was a great idea. Then I ended it with the enigma of Ted Bundy. And I thought, after writing about, I think the exact total number of pages is 1,485 pages. After that many pages on a case, that really should be it. I mean, I've really said all I wanted to say. And then just a couple weeks after the book was released, I had three people contact me. They all, three might have been valid, but one lady had gotten the information from her deceased aunt and she didn't have enough. So I said, well, thank you very much, but there's not a lot I can do with that.
Right.
But the other two women turned out to be real. I did some checking and we talked and I asked them various questions and they turned out to be really, really, really good people, witnesses that had actually had contact with them. So I thought to myself, well, you know, what am I going to do with these? These are really good and they need to get out there on the printed page. So they'll be there for future researchers because, you know, these people that were involved in the case, are a lot of them are passing away now. There's Jerry Thompson's gone. Ron Holmes is gone. Al Carlisle's gone. Lorraine Fargo's gone. And God knows who else is gone that I don't even know about. So, and you know, nobody's getting any younger. So I thought to myself, you know what? I'll ask my publisher. He may not be on board with this, but maybe I can write a yearly journal of these new testimonies that come in. And of course, since this book's been published, I've already got one from a retired circuit court judge who had a run-in with someone who was likely Bundy. And I'll add that to the next journal. But I just say to the publisher, I get these stories. If I think they're valid, I'll write about them. And then maybe in the journal, I'll delve into maybe certain aspects of the case that need further maybe study. I can do that. And I said, do you think that's something that you'd like to do? And at the time, I'd already been writing about it, just writing about it anyway. So they said, yes. And I said, you know, it's not going to be as long as a normal book would be, anywhere from 200, 250 to 300 pages. It's not going to be that. It might be, since I'm doing it yearly, maybe 150 pages, something like that. And they said, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's fine. So they came up with the title, Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal. And I think it's good to look at it like that because it's something that as long as these testimonies keep coming in, I'll do it. And if it's every year or every year and a half or whatever, it doesn't matter. I'll keep putting it out there. And, you know, Catherine Ramsland is a friend of mine. And, you know, she even invited me to speak at a serial killer conference at Duquesne University. So we've been friends for years. She's really a great person.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's really great. And she's so knowledgeable. She always blurbs my book. She's always been kind enough to do it. And I just can't thank her enough. But she said something in the blurbing of this latest book. And it's absolutely true. And I love how she words it. I didn't come up with anything like this, but she said, we can still chip away at his secrets, meaning Bundy's secrets. And man, that is exactly what happens with this book, The Yearly Journal, is because of this thing. We'll talk about it more later, but the very fact that it just appeared out of nowhere because of the testimony of people, because of one testimony, Susan Milner's, out of the last book I wrote, The Enigma of Ted Bundy, where it proved Bundy was hunting near his apartment the first month he had got there, late into the month. or possibly very, very early October, like maybe the first, but likely in late September. And then the new testimony of Frieda Ade and the other lady who lived in that apartment, and Bundy came to their door. And we'll talk about that more. Classic Bundy, the language he used. He was looking for another woman that lived there. But I was never searching for any of this. And yet, because of certain things starting to feel like a pattern in a puzzle, this one dropped in, another one dropped in. Then that started ruling out this other false story. And it was just amazing to see this come about. And it's like Catherine said, we're chipping away at some of his secrets that he took. The only Bundy knew that he was hunting close to his apartment, which if you're going to be a psychopath and try to abduct women, I would think, because see, I'm normal, I would think you need to go on the other side of Salt Lake somewhere where if you do something stupid and blow it and somebody sees you, they won't be in your area. But no. Bundy started hunting in his proverbial backyard. And now that's been proven. And so has it that he couldn't have been doing this other thing, which we'll talk about later. But this is what drives me on. Now, like right now, I've just started a major book on the killings that the Nazis did in World War II. And it's going to take me a year, year and a half to write. But I'll still do the journal. And as long as people still give me information, as long as I think further aspects of the case need to be written about, as long as we can still chip away at Bundy's secrets, I am committed to doing that. So anyway, that kind of brings you up on it.
Yes, thank you. Let's get to, as you write, you talk about Bundy's failed abductions,
yes,
but you also talk to people like Ronald Holmes, the criminologist,
yes,
and you talk about the information that Bundy gave about himself, of course, in the third person.
Yes.
That I talk about his need or a need to repeat the killings again and again, and the killer, serial killer, learns to stalk, wait and kill. And with each killing, he gets better at stalking, the waiting, mm-hmm, and the killing. And Bundy spoke of the force.
Yes.
To become so strong.
Yes.
And he talks about a case where, you mentioned a case where the force wasn't that strong and he was in his redemption phase, or mm-hmm, he was at least trying not to reoffend, not to kill again.
Right.
But you talk about also the failed abductions, and many of the people aren't so aware of Bundy's, because Bundy didn't want to talk about the teen victims.
No.
But you say that he attacked two 12-year-olds.
Yes.
And so you talk about a half dozen other ones.
Yes.
So tell us about also the idea that for all the women that he may have killed, which you estimate and others estimate are 30 plus, you say maybe even as many as 40.
Yes.
But in order to be able to approach those people successfully and then abduct them, you say that there have to be mathematically many, many approaches. And then you show examples of that.
Yes.
So tell us of examples of that to show the magnitude of the amount of approaches that Ted would have to do.
Yes.
To be while he was on his hunt.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this case for the last 16 years. I mean, it's daily. It's every day. And I've thought of various things that have to add up in Bundy's life, things that he didn't talk about. And everybody wants to know how many people Bundy killed. You know, Bundy told Bill Hagemeyer at the end, he said, I don't know. You know, in the movie, if you see No Man of God, Bill's pressing him on that. He said, Bundy goes, that again. And Hagemeyer goes, yeah, that again. And that conversation occurred or wouldn't be in there. And he said, I don't know how many. He said, they just all get confusing. I don't know. So, you know, some people say it could, I say it's almost got to be around the low 40s, but it could go 50 or higher. We don't know. Even he doesn't know. But nobody usually, nobody really has ever that I know of posed the question, at least publicly or in print, as to how many close calls were out there. I know that when Bundy went to Pocatello, Idaho on May 5th, he drove up. It's a straight shot out of Salt Lake, I think about 180 miles. And, you know, he got up there. It was cold. And that's something I found out when I was writing the Bundy murders. He never got a co-ed that day. He hunted all day. He got his room at the Holiday Inn, which is to the right off of I-15 after you get into the city of Pocatello. And it's not in the downtown part, but it's in like a suburban part. And he got off there and then he went across underneath the 15 after he got his room and everything. And he went to the university there in Pocatello and he hunted all day and he hunted into the night. And when they asked him about, would anybody else have noticed, who else maybe could you have attempted to abduct? He said, well, a lot of the abductions failed before they went anywhere. And the women would have no knowledge of that. Absolutely no knowledge of that. So he did admit that he was caught up in a women-only dormitory. It was a high-rise. I think it was 4 or 5 stories. But anyway, he was caught up there by a male security guard, and he shouldn't even be in there. So they asked, what are you doing in here? He said, well, he just made up some lame excuse. They said, well, I'd like to see some identification. He said, I don't have anything on me. He said, well, you have to leave the building right now. And so they put him out. Now, what I found out for the Bundy murders, because I got the file on Le Culbert, one of the 12-year-olds he murdered the next day on the 6th, but he hunted all day and into the night. And he can't, God only knows how many people he approached. And one of the reasons why he really couldn't get any women, he wasn't as familiar with the area, but that's not really what was thwarting him, in my view. It was May 5th, but it was colder than normal. Winter was still unwilling to completely relinquish its grasp. And it wouldn't let go. And there were snow showers on both days that Bundy was there. It could be sunny, but there were still some snow showers coming in and stuff like that. And it was cold. It was colder than normal. So, you know, he just didn't get anybody. God knows how many people. Was it 10? No, it can't be 10. That would be too low. He spent hours and hours trying to obtain a victim. I would say that easily in Pocatello, it was probably for May 5th, 30 to 40. And that's easy to do if you're asking women here and there to help you. It's already been proven that when he was on the day, I'll skip over to Karen Campbell, where he got her on the evening of January 12th, 1975 at the Wildwood Inn, he had already admitted to Hagemeyer and to other people that he had been hunting down. And Mike Fisher told me, and I didn't put this in the Bundy murders, but Mike Fisher said, and then I read it later in an article and added it to one of my companion volumes, but Bundy had told Fisher, he said, I was using crutches and a briefcase in the city of Aspen earlier in the day and dropping it and trying to get women to help me. And he had a run-in with one particular woman that I've got the thing on, but she wouldn't go with him. So before he got Campbell, he was down in Aspen itself hunting. But then he said, and this was Mike's words, he said, I went up amongst the lodges. And if you go there today, there's a lot of ski lodges there. And the Wildwood Inn is kind of like all the way up the hill at the tip end of it. And it's like, if you're not looking carefully, you're going to miss it. And you will end up in another lodge. So how he ended up there, I don't know, but that's where he went. But he had already... And this was, I guess he got Campbell around, I'd say around 7:30 p.m. And he was hunting around the pool area, the outdoor pool area at the Wildwood Inn. And I bring this out in the Bundy Murders second edition, exactly how he got Campbell. And so, you know, he was trying to get the attention of another woman. So, and then Karen Campbell saw him from the balcony. And you got to remember that, as I said in the Bundy Murders, the steam coming off the pool is because it's so cold. Mm-hmm. And it's an outdoor heated pool. That'll kind of envelop people and then it'll kind of spread out and you'll see people and whatever. But Karen was able to spot him. He looked like he was needing help, and being a nurse, she offered her help, and that was a fatal mistake. And so then they went out to the side parking lot, and that's where Bundy assaulted her and got her into his VW. But how many people did he hunt once he went to, how many women did he try to get to go with him after he failed in Aspen, stumbling on crutches and a briefcase before Karen Campbell offered? Only God knows. So there's lots of people in every event. Now, Bundy, you know, I don't add hitchhikers in that because Bundy was a planner of murder for the most part. He would stalk women. He stalked women a lot more than people realize. But he also was an opportunist. So whenever he picked up a hitchhiker, that's okay. That's going to be an easy kill. And, you know, if he was in the mood to kill her, and he almost always was, it was the rare occasion when he changed his mind and didn't. But there's so many people out there. So I came up with an estimate that if Bundy even abducted on the lower end, like 30 to 35, 36 people, you're looking at, if you just say he had to talk to at least 10 people for every person that he was able to abduct, you're looking at a number of 350 people. So that's a lot of people to encounter Bundy and not go with him. And they never had any idea what a deadly situation they were looking at when they were talking to him. So there's a lot. It could be 400. It could be over 400. There's only God knows. Because, for example, he hunted on two different days, Central Washington State College. But he didn't get Susan Rancourt until around 10:15, 10:30 on April 17th, 1974. So how many did he talk to that afternoon and on the other day where he apparently got no one? How many? What? 30, 40, 50 more? We don't know. We don't know. So he had contact with a lot of women that he intended to kill, but they just would not go with him for one reason or another. And thank God that one lady that did follow Bundy to his car at Central Washington State College. And I elaborate on this. I mean, I talk about it in the Bundy murders, but I actually went to CWSC for the second book, The Trail of Ted Bundy. And at the time, now that whole area now has been eaten up by parking lots and new buildings have been built there. But at the time Bundy did this, you know, they had to leave the library, turn right, and then they crossed a little man-made bridge between a little round building called the Group Conference Center and the library. And then they would angle off. And when they angled off, you know, Bundy, he never left anything to chance. He had parked his VW on the most remote area on campus, about 150 feet from the library. No buildings around as you see today. There was only one building that was called Black Hall. Today, if you look at Black Hall from the air, it's two long buildings connected. It looks like an H shape from the air. But back then, it was just one long building that was just kind of like right next to the library. And between the two was a little round place called the Group Conference Center with this unusual little tin roof. And they walked across this man-made bridge. Then they turned left, they angled left off of that. And then they walked into the ever-increasing darkness. And Bundy had parked right underneath a railroad trestle that was bounded by tall grass. And it was rarely traveled by students. And so he picked the perfect place. And the one lady went with him and she started to feel very suspicious of him. And what Bundy did was, you know, and I say this in a number of my books, but Bundy, like a lot of killers, when he sensed that he had somebody, he would start going into that altered state of murder. Yes. And if you look at the testimony of this one lady who survived her encounter with Bundy at CWSC, she said when she was talking to him, I mean, his eyes were normal. He didn't look weird at all. But as they were walking to his car, she turned and looked at him and she said his eyes were really weird. And I asked Al Carlisle about that as I was writing the Bundy murders because I wanted to kind of get it right. What happened, do you think? He said, well, a lot of women have reported to me that right before someone attacked them and assaulted them, they had this change in their eyes. And it would, he said, I think it's a neurotransmitter change. But in any event, it's getting into that altered state. So she went through the motions, but she, you know, she got to Bundy's car and he asked her to get in and she said no. And when she looked in the car, and this really bothered her, she said that the passenger seat was out and he would often do that. So he'd have room to lay an unconscious woman in there and throw a blanket over her. But she was able to get away from him. So we know how Bundy did things within his attempts to abduct women, but she got away from him. So how many did he really hunt at CWSC over a period of 2 days? I think 40 to 50 would be a conservative estimate that he would run into. Where I mean, a lot of girls probably just blew him off. So I'm sorry, I can't, I got to go.
Incredible.
But he spent hours. Yeah. So there's a lot out there, even today, that have never come forth. And a lot of these women tell me, I never went to the police because, I mean, it was almost like a nothing encounter.
Yeah.
And as I talk in the book, there was a lady from Oregon State University. And when I'm writing, when I'm talking to her a couple of years ago, or you know, whenever that was, I asked her what year, and she didn't really know. It was early 70s. And she went back and I said, well, if you could find out something. And she either said to me, she contacted me back, and she said, sure she said 1973, but my mind could play tricks on me. She might have said 1975. And I said to her then, and listen, she was so sweet. She said, as she started the conversation, she said, I'm absolutely convinced it's Bundy because I got a good look at him. I talked to him. You know, we exchanged words and I remember what he sounded like. I remember his face and how his hair was. And she said, I just know it was him. And I asked what the encounter was. Here's what the encounter was. She's like reading something. She steps out into the street. He's moving slowly through the campus. He almost bumps into his VW. He stops, rolls down his window, the passenger side, talks to her. They exchange pleasantries, you know, she says, I'm sorry, whatever. And he said, well, look, he must have said something like he's new on campus, whatever. And could she show him around? It was some kind of excuse. I can't remember exactly what she said, other than the fact that he was very nice. She got a great look at him. She remembered what he sounded like, and she identified his vehicle. And he got his VW in 73, but when she told me it was like 73 or could have been 75 because I didn't really write it down, I thought, well, I said, no, it can't be him because he was there in 1974. And I had forgotten about, I had completely forgotten about yeah. that Bundy admitted to killing two in Oregon. And because he was such a creature of habit, he obviously went back there. It could have been in 73 because he got his Volkswagen then, his little beige Volkswagen, just like right. you said. And so what did she say to me? She said, oh, well, I guess I'm wrong. Yeah. And I don't have her name. And I hope she reads my book and recontacts me because she's still under contacting me in the first place. So I said to myself that I will never, ever, under any circumstances, not write down everything that is told to me, whether I think I'm going to use it or not.
Yeah.
So that's what I've adopted since then. But anyway, there's lots of women out there still that had encounters. And like I say, I just got contacted, a number of months ago from a retired circuit court judge out in Oregon. And she had an experience with what she believes is Bundy. And this was in 1970 or 71. And Bundy borrowed a lot of vehicles. He always did. That's one thing that has surfaced over the last 16 years of research. He would borrow vehicles to search for victims more than most people realize. And she said it was a beige VW. And I said, well, he didn't get his beige VW into this because this that happened to her was in 71, 72. And she didn't make a police report about it. But I found out, and I'm going to do more investigation on this because this story is going to go into the next journal. But she said, and I don't want to get into everything that happened while she was in the car with him, but she was able to get away. But I found out that Bundy's good friend, Marlon Bortman, had owned a beige VW around this same time. And I know that he had borrowed vehicles from the Bortmans on other occasions when they didn't have that beige VW. So he did have it. That's what I have heard. So I'm going to do more investigation into that. But he could have borrowed it and it could be somebody else's. But was it an encounter with Bundy? I can't say for sure. She can't say for sure. But it's interesting enough to put it in there, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if it wasn't Bundy. And that's based on some things that she said he did while she was in the car. But I'm going to go into that in the book.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Kevin, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. It was a typical night. Lisa and I had dinner. We talked a little bit about her work. Then suddenly I disappeared. But no worries. I was just spending some quality time playing Best Fiends. You may have people wondering about your sudden disappearances, but I totally understand if you enjoy playing as much as I do. What I like the most about Best Fiends is that it's totally distracting. I'm completely immersed and I lose myself in playing every time. I just pick up and play a few levels anytime I have a few minutes. Feels great to beat another level or get in the zone. Hard to believe right now, but I'm almost at a level 1,000 and only thousands to go. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game featuring always new adventures and challenges and thousands of levels. With dozens of unique fiends to collect, you customize a team of your fiends to defeat the menacing slugs. Power up your favorite fiends to new levels and watch as they transform and get stronger. You can even play offline if your internet connection is lost. New events and challenges pop up all year. There's chances to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. Download your new favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play. You'll even get $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, Kevin, you include, and you had alluded to it already, you mentioned this incredible story that backs up a lot of the information that you have already written about, but new information in this journal, of the yearly journal. You spoke with a person named Frieda Aide, and this is regarding Debbie Christensen and her daughter. And they were friends. Frieda Aide and Debbie Christensen were friends who had moved from Florida to Salt Lake in July 1974 at the Annie Laurie Apartments. And you got this story from Jody Jones, which is, I guess, Debbie's daughter. And so they were living in Salt Lake. And one night a man knocked on the door. You write about their experience. What did they experience? Why did you include this? Why were they so certain they encountered Bundy?
Well, this is a 100% proven that Bundy came to the door. And here's what happened. They were good friends. Frieda will say that she's got a memory like a steel trap. She remembers everything. And I didn't get to talk to Jody's mother, but she told me the story. And it almost matched perfectly with what Frieda told me. And here's what happened. So they were living in a brownstone that, if you go from Bundy's apartment at 565 First Avenue, he lived in what is known the Avenues. And if you go five blocks west of that, heading towards downtown, and then you turn at the light and go three blocks south, you'll run into the Laurie Ann Apartments. And it's there are these brownstones. And when I was there in 2006 and again in 2015, I was all over this area, but I had no idea and wouldn't hear this testimony until years later. But I had to pass the place on numerous occasions. But they got a knock on the door one afternoon, and they opened it up, and they both came to the door. And there was this man that they later identified as Bundy. And the first thing out of his mouth is, "Hi, I don't mean to bother you." And in the journal, I talk about how things like this, classic Bundy, he was constantly saying, "Excuse me, miss," or "I'm sorry to bother you," or this or that. He'd have all these pleasantries where he'd greet them. And here's what he said. He said, "I'm looking for a woman that lives in your apartment." He couldn't remember her name, somewhere in her complex. He said he described her, and she had long dark hair, part in the middle, whatever. He described her. They knew of her, but didn't know her name. And he said, "I'm a law student at the University of Utah, and she's in my class, and I borrowed her notes, and I'd like to return them to her. I just need to know what apartment she lives in." And they said, and I remember, you know, Frieda said, "Well, we know who you're talking about, but we don't know her name. We don't know her apartment, but she's a telephone operator. And when we're getting off work and we're coming home, she's leaving for work. And a lot of times we'll pass each other, you know, like say hello or whatever." And she said, "If you want me to, we see her quite a bit. I can, if she comes out later to go to work, if she's worked like today, whatever, I'll give her the notes." And he said, "No, that's okay. I'll see her in class tomorrow, and I can give her the notes then." And I remember Frieda said, she's such a an extrovert. She said, "It's a wonder I didn't invite him in for dinner, because he was just very polite and things like that." And she said later, she said, "You know, obviously they were on the first floor, so they could obviously see his car." And she said, "No, we saw his car around the neighborhood quite a bit." And so that is classic Bundy. And what he would do, he would stalk women. So apparently he was going down. And again, Frieda said this, so I have to say this. I said, "When was this?" She said, "It was before the murders of October." And as the case progressed, the authorities looked back, and of course, it was Nancy Wilcox who disappeared, thought to have been a runaway. Later, when these women started to disappear, they started to consider her a homicide victim.
Right.
And so they kind of started classing her like that, that she might be linked with all the other women. Jerry Thompson worked most of these cases. And so it was before October. Now, when I was talking to Jody, she said, "Well, Mom," and this is why Frieda said, "Well, she just can't remember. She was thinking it happened like before he got arrested, just like weeks before he got arrested." She said, Frieda told me, "No." She said, it was really before the murders in October. And she said that's when it happened. So it wasn't until, you know, the following October when he was actually hit the news and arrested, and his face started to hit the papers. But she said, "Yeah." And so having seen his vehicle, we remember seeing his vehicle parked in various areas around the neighborhood. And because it was a little distance from his place, you know, he would just drive and park there and he'd look for victims. Again, this is all happening the first month he was there. And September was a was a busy month for Bundy. He didn't even arrive in the city. He left on the 2nd. It was one of the nice things I was able to discover from the Bundy murders. Some people say he left on the 3rd. Other people say early September, but I was able to trace his gas receipts, and he left actually on Labor Day, September 2nd of 74. And again, and then he picked up a hitchhiker later. And then sometime after, close to 11 o'clock, he murdered the hitchhiker, the Idaho hitchhiker. And then he didn't arrive until the early morning hours of September 3rd. Then, you know, he's busy setting up his apartment. And then he goes home. He flies home in the middle of the month, gets a truck that he has loaded with furniture, and has Glenn drive back with him. And I don't know how long Glenn stayed, but he drove back with him and helped him get his furniture upstairs and stuff like that. And maybe went home the next day and flew back home. And then, of course, he had to enroll in school a little, you know, go over there and make a presentation that he was indeed there and was ready to start classes. Although after he did all that, he was killing so much and started in October, as I said, that he wasn't there very much, maybe not any more than 3 times that first semester. But he was very busy. And so, again, this hunting pattern emerged. And the reason why it emerged, when Frieda Aide and the other lady, which story came through Jody, when they determined when this was, I immediately thought back to Susan Milner, whose testimony is in the last book of the 6 books, The Enigma of Ted Bundy. And what happened there, she was even closer to Bundy's apartment. And she had had a little argument with her husband and just left to go for a walk. And she stopped at a school. She told me, Susan, they lived in above a pharmacy on the corner. And they're like, I think she's like a couple blocks from Bundy's place. Well, she walked down, and this is like in the afternoon. And she walked down like a block or so, went into like a schoolyard that has a fence, and she went in where the opening was. And she sat then she walked down to the swings, and she was just swinging. And Bundy pulled up in his VW, parked, got out, and came and leaned on the fence and put, you know, how people will put both their arms on the fence and just lean on it.
Right.
And he said, you know, how you doing and whatever. And he said, listen, you know, would you like to take a ride with me? And I remember she said, look, I was mad at my husband, but I was just married, you know, and she was pregnant, although it wasn't showing. She said, I'm certainly not going to ruin my marriage by going on a ride with a guy. So she told him no. Well, he asked her again. She said no. And with that, she said he kind of looked a little discouraged. And she said he tapped his fist a couple times on the top of the fence and said, okay, and then walked off, got his VW and gone. And that's another example of an almost know-nothing story. But at the same time, it is a story because she identified him after he surfaced, you know,
yes.
a year later. So again, and that was, and again, she said, I got married on September 10th. And it was just, she thinks a couple weeks after that. So again, we're talking late September. And so I'm figuring out, and that's why Catherine Ramsland said, we're still able to chip away at his secrets. So he knew where he had been hunting that first month before he started actually killing. So he again, he's failing. He's failing. He's not able to get who he wants to get. So we don't know how many that first month, but he just landed in Utah and he's already starting to hunt. As busy as September was, he still had time to hunt and kill women. So that came to the surface, and at the same time, and we can go into it later, that, in my view, that totally kills this myth that Ted Bundy knew Laura and Amy. Just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. That myth as Bundy, just think of this. Listen, I think, and I liked him. I wish he would have been alive when I was writing the Bundy murders. I really wanted to talk to him, but Richard Lark, I love his book, The Deliberate Stranger. But he had passed away, and I so regretted not being able to talk with him. But anyway, he has something about that in the book. And there were some people that believed this connection. See, these people came to them afterwards. One of the guys died in the 1980s, but there's this other woman, I'm not going to say her name, but she said that Bundy, you know, came and made friends with them in September, you know. Oh, she even said over the summer when he wasn't there. But the talk was, this myth was, is that some people believe it to this day. I didn't, so I didn't put it in the Bundy murders. But the myth was, is that Bundy, after Giddy, if you look at what the record says and what they said, is that Bundy was coming down there like in the fall, September, all that area through there, and making friends, going down to tiny Lehigh, Utah. At the time, it has less than 5,000 people there. And apparently, as the myth goes, he went down there, made friends with some of the guys, got to meet Laura and Amy, spent time with her. Now, he's busy back here hunting women, going home in the middle of the month, not arriving until the 3rd, having to set up things with school, even though he's not going to be there much. He's busy, and on top of that, he's hunting in his own proverbial backyard. The thought that he'd come to Utah and zip down to tiny, tiny, minuscule Lehigh, Utah, and spending all this time, day after day, making friends with these guys and Laura and Amy at a place called Brown's Cafe, which wasn't really the name. It was the nickname for this place. It just didn't happen. It didn't happen. Now, I didn't know all of this. And I didn't know his hunting pattern for that month, which could disprove this other thing. I didn't know the hunting pattern. But when I wrote about, because I didn't mention it in the Bundy murders, when I wrote about this in the Trail of Ted Bundy that came out in 2016, I said, this is not something I use. It didn't feel good to me then. It doesn't feel good to me now. In other words, I wouldn't use it again if I rewrote the Bundy murders. I said, I'm not saying it can't be true. I guess it's possible it could be true, but there's just too many things that don't add up for me. But here's the story. And I gave, yes.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You were talking about this story that, again, you talk about in this journal, is that many of the myths about Bundy are dispelled. About that he would operate in broad daylight, like Lake Sammamish, where he had abducted two in one day. But you say that soon after, because of the composite drawing, because people had witnessed him, so many people had seen him and even heard his name, Ted, that he resorted back to nighttime hunting.
Yes,
you talk about that in all your research, you realize that his night hunting is where he started. Tell us about that.
Yes. You know, everybody knows he started at night, but nobody has ever commented on how, what I believe, the events of Lake Sammamish affected him, and he went immediately back into nighttime hunting. No one had ever talked about that, but I had thought about this for a long time. And I first announced it publicly because I knew I was going to write about it in Enigma. But I, at the serial killer conference, I said, I've known this for a long time, but I'm going to tell you here because I knew it was going to be soon in this other book. And so in September 2019, I was down at this conference at Duquesne University. And I said, if you look at what he did, he encountered some problems at Lake Sammamish. He started his killing in the middle of the night. He started it with the attack on Karen Sparks. He then went to the early morning attack, like probably between 2 and 3 a.m. or 2 and 4, but no later than that, I'm sure. He got Linda Ann Healy and whisked her away from her home that she shared with the other co-eds. And everything was nighttime until April 17th, 1974. He was hunting a little bit in the afternoon, noonish. He was out in the daylight, and then he hunted all night that night. And then the other time he was at CWSC, we only have a record for him hunting at night. But he stayed with the night hunting all the way through Brenda Ball. It was already dark when he hunted Donna Manson at Evergreen State College. It was about 7:30. And I put an enigma when sundown was and all these. You can see he's hunting just basically at night. Then he edges himself into daylight. And then by July of 74, he is hunting in broad daylight. But because, you know, he had used his real name, Ted, because one woman followed him to his car and identified it as like a beige VW, he kind of spooked him. He never talked about it, to my knowledge, to anybody, but he immediately goes into nighttime hunting again. And so after that, you look at all the women that he started to abduct and murder in Utah, every one of them is under the cover of darkness. And unless there's somebody out there that we don't know that he killed, he would remain getting people in darkness, whether it be early evening or, you know, well, of course, like when he got January 12th, 75 at Gary Campbell. Around 7:30, I think sundown was like before 5 p.m. So he was in darkness, and he didn't come back out into the light that we know of from the record until he abducted Denise Oliverson. And I think that was April 6th of 1975. So he retreated back into the darkness. No one had ever written about that. No one had ever spoken about that. But again, these are the kind of things that come up with me after spending so many years looking at the case. Another thing that I brought up in one of my companion volumes, and I first announced this because I knew I was going to write about it in the book. I first announced this on my Facebook page or on a Bundy site. I can't remember which, but I said, you know, Bundy, he was so broke all the time that, you know, you absolutely have to know that he took the money, bills and change from the victims that he murdered when they had money on them. There's no reason he wouldn't have. He needed money too badly.
Sure.
Everybody said, I never thought of that, but that's gotta be right. A couple people said, no, he probably didn't. And I don't know why they would say that, because Bundy was a thief. He would steal. He would never bury money with them. He wouldn't do it. He'd take the money. In fact, I'll never be able to prove it. But he was so broke that after he killed Janice Ott and Denise Naslund, having abducted them both from Lake Sammamish, I'm sure they had some money on them. At least one of them did. Probably Janice, because she had brought her purse and stuff. And Denise had left her purse in the car, so she probably didn't have any money on her. But I bet Janice did. And when he took Liz out and Tina out to get hamburgers and ice cream that night, there's a good chance he used money that came from Ott. But these are the kind of things you think about as you study the case, and they just kind of pop up. And I don't know when it happened, but I thought, wait a minute, there's a pattern here. He starts off hunting at night. He's in the daytime. Then he does this really egregious double abduction in broad daylight at a place where there's 40,000 people, including the police department that's having a picnic there. And then they're looking for Ted. They're looking for a VW. And that must have kind of shaken him a bit. And then he retreats back into the darkness. So, yes, these are just the kind of things that I end up seeing. And again, that just kind of came to me. I said, well, wait a minute. We have a real pattern here. Starts at night, early morning, night, afternoon, around noon, bam, all day. I mean, you know, at different times during the bright, sunny day at Lake Sammamish, then immediately back into the darkness. So, yeah. So, but this thing about where his hunting pattern was the first month he was in Utah, I never saw that coming. I couldn't have figured it out. If it wouldn't have been for the Milner testimony and then the two women that opened the door to him, and he was all polite and everything, and he said, I'm a law student, I just want to give the lady her notes back. You know, but then there it was. And again, I like what Catherine Ramsell said. It really is about chipping away at a secret. So, and that's why I said in the book, and you read it, you know, where you know, these testimonies are buried, new information come forth, discoveries await. And so, you know, that's how you got to look at it, especially if you're writing about a case that goes on a long time. I mean, the very fact that I'm here, having written 7 books about Bundy, now over close to 1,600 pages, I never envisioned any of this. I didn't even envision on writing the Bundy murders. If it wouldn't have been for Jim Massey, my good friend who's passed away now, he's a probation and parole officer here in Louisville, and his good friendship with Jerry Thompson that he met in the very early 1980s, I would have never written this book on Bundy because I got to meet Jerry. And from there, it just took off. So, yeah, it's been an amazing journey. But to think that was able to come up with so many new testimonies. How about the one with the lady that encountered Bundy as she was on her way to Hank's Tavern in North Tacoma? And Bundy pulls up in a El Camino. And he said, he acted like he wasn't from around there or something. And he said he was looking for a particular place, which turned out to be a landmark restaurant. And she said, she tried to give him her, you know, directions. He said, I can't. And then this is so much like Bundy. He said, if you could just get in the car and show me, take me there, I will give you gas money to get back. And she thought, great, right. I'll have gas money for my friends. We can all have some beer on it. And she went over to get into the car. And she looked in because she was standing back from him. He was coming on the street towards her, and she was on the other side of the street. And I guess she came over to talk to him, got close to him. And then when she came around, when she agreed to do it, she looked in there. the passenger bucket seat had been removed.
Wow.
And she said her friend Pam had the same encounter with the same guy and the same blackish, bluish El Camino with the seat out. Like I think she said 3 weeks later, I had to check the book, but they compared notes. It was the same guy, and that guy had to have been Bundy. And she said, you know, I wasn't really familiar with all of his crimes, but when his face started like hitting the papers and the news, I said, well, that's the guy. You know, these are just things that happen and failed abductions. And if you look, and I told Mike McCann about it, a friend of mine and a fellow Bundy researcher, he said, oh yeah, I know Hank's well, it's a great place. And he said, there's a Bavarian restaurant there, the location like right there. There was a Bavarian restaurant where Bundy met his cousin, John Cal, and had dinner there with him right after the Kathy Parks murder. And so that's something that he discovered for one of his, you know, research things. But Bundy knew that area well. He was all over. And if you look at the distance he was from like Hank's and where Top of the Ocean restaurant was, that's the name of the place that was the landmark restaurant. And then where Bundy's parents lived. I mean, they're just not that far from each other. So again, he's hunting near to where his parents live. And you know, he's driving this car. Where he got this car, I have no idea. But again, he borrowed a lot of cars. So there's cars out there with probably not now, they're probably in junkyards, but traces of, maybe hair or whatever, maybe a splotch of blood down the weather felt on the window or whatever. Who knows? I mean, it's out there. And so these testimonies, they just keep coming forth. And boy, some of them don't have the ring of truth and others do. And you just talk to them and ask them more questions. And it just confirms that they were indeed, they indeed had an encounter with Ted Bundy.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, in this book, what we haven't spoken about is you had just mentioned Kathy Parks. But in this book, you have an interesting transcript of the biographical memorial of Kathy Parks, 1954 to 1974.
Yes.
And you've included her story in the Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries. But this is a memorial written by her grandfather, Charles Parks Sr., and it was completed in October 1975, just as Bundy was about to become a serious suspect in the case. And so her parents were Chaz Jr. and Catherine. And so he goes through the whole thing, the abduction. But it's very interesting, some of the information that he has at that time and that he's included in this memorial, which includes the abduction, but it includes also her life. What did you get from this memorial and why did you include it? Why was it so interesting to include in this book?
Well, yes. You know, it was interesting. When I was writing the Bundy murders, I got a tremendous amount of files from the King County Archives. And I started to read that and I thought, wow, this is really something. You could imagine this grieving grandfather taking the time to write this stuff. And as you say, it was completed in like October of 1975. So that was the month that Bundy was just about to be revealed. And I always thought it was just very, you know, it just had a lot to it. And it came out of a file that, and I put this in the book, the journal, if anybody wants to see it themselves or have a copy, you can obtain this. I think that's box 34 and something, maybe that file 13, something like that. But I looked at it and I thought, you know, this is really something. You never see this sort of thing in a homicide investigative file.
Yes.
And what he had done, he had written this and he had basically written it for his family, but he wanted them to have a copy of it as well. And so they put it in the file. And in, I think, the Trail of Ted Bundy, I alluded to it and I put a little portion of, like, I think the first page. And then I elaborated on another aspect of it in one of the other things, because it impressed me so much. And even though there's a few tiny minor mistakes, it's surprising that it's so accurate. And so wherever there's like these little flubs or whatever, I clear that up in a thing called author's note, and then I clear it up. But to have this thing put together by him, where his family had dealt a lot with the investigator Harrison from OSU, from the school from which he disappeared, and other investigators, they were grateful. And so he wanted to put this together because it was such a loss losing her at such a young age. And, you know, I just thought people have asked about it. People seem to be interested in it. And then when I got to reading the personal letters, because I put letters of Kathy's in some of my previous books, including the Bundy murders. And in fact, I think in Ted Bundy's murders mysteries, I put quite a bit. But for this thing, he adds a lot of letters between, well, a number of letters between Kathy and, you know, her dad and other people and
yes.
the things she's written. And you know, he doesn't pull any punches. And he talks about, one point he said, you know, I just feel like I never really knew my granddaughter. And he also talked about how she had all these dreams. But his main concern was like, well, how are you going to support yourself? So it talks about the good things, that talks about the bad. But I thought, you know, most people are never going to see that.
Yes.
And it's so touching, really. To me, of course, this guy's long dead, but I thought I should include it because it is a rare bird. I've never encountered anything so personal in an investigative file, and I've looked at lots of them. I guarantee it, not just about Bundy, but other people. I've never seen any kind of memorial like this ever, and I just think it was very unique. So I wanted to include it in this book, and I believe I made the right decision because it's very interesting to read because as you read it, you're almost feeling the agony of the Parks family. And you just have to sympathize with them. And it's, I'm sure it was a catharsis. It was cathartic for him to do it. And it was important to do it. And he said something at the end. And this was basically, again, for the Parks family. He said, you know, like, I'm going to paraphrase here. He said, you can visit her anytime just by calling her up in your memory. And that's true. That's one thing that you can do. So it's just very sad on the one hand. On the other hand, it's heartwarming. But it's one of those things that I think that we talk a lot about the case file. We show a lot of things from the detectives. And I wanted to show something that was so incredibly important to the Parks family that the grandfather completed. I just think it was worthy for the rest of the world to see it as well.
It's also, it repeats the story that you've told before, that when she went missing, of course, they had no idea that it just could be the work of a serial killer. But her father experienced a massive heart attack that same day. So the mother was instructed to not tell the father that the daughter was missing. And so you just have an incredible disadvantage. Well, not disadvantage, just a horrible scene. That confluence of a disastrous confluence of events that happened to start. And of course, they don't know for a while. And the usual people are suspected, the boyfriend. And so it takes a while. And then as the grandfather writes that her body and bones are found among the other bodies as well. So it is just talking about the discovery. And as you say, Ted as a suspect in these cases and unearthing of people missing women and young girls.
Yeah. You know, when I wrote the Bundy murders, I talk about how Kathy got a call that morning from her sister, Sharon Kaler, that her dad had a heart attack. And Sharon said, no, don't leave school. We'll keep you updated on his progress. And then they contacted her later that afternoon and said he's doing better. It was apparently a mild heart attack. And so, you know, and then of course it was inevitable because she loved to take her nocturnal strolls. And, you know, Bundy ended up encountering her in the cafeteria after 11 p.m. And then I convinced her to go with him and that was it. But yeah, it's very sad. You know, if you look at something similar to that, so you're the poor father, they're not telling him right away because they don't want him to have another heart attack. Dean Kent was an executive with an oil company and he had suffered a serious heart attack. And the first night he went out to do something was when his daughter, Debbie, invited them to come see the play at Piedmont High.
Oh, yes.
That was his first night out.
Wow.
And you know what's weird? I've often said this, and I've said this in some of the companion volumes. Very often things happen by chance. I say things like, what if Raymond Godowsky's children would have accompanied Karen all the way to the room, which they wanted to do.
Right.
But she said no and sent them back after she reached the elevator. Bundy wouldn't have been able to kidnap her. What if Donna Manson took another route or whatever? These things happen by chance. And by chance that very night, the play didn't get started on time. It was supposed to end at 10 p.m., but it didn't get started on time. And it ran over. And because Debbie's brother was at the roller rink and was told he'd be picked up at 10, and they called the roller rink, but they wouldn't let him talk to him or, you know, pass off a message for some strange reason. She had to go and get him. Or they were going to go. She said, no, you haven't seen the play. I'll do it. And of course, then she disappeared. But all of these, you know, things happen by chance. And like, if the play would have started on and ended on, we would never even know the name of Debbie Kent.
Yeah.
It's odd. It's odd, isn't it?
Yes. Well, as you say, Ted Bundy was also had distinct MO, but he also was a opportunist.
Yes.
I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much, Kevin, for coming on and talking about your latest, Ted Bundy, the Yearly Journal, Kevin M. Sullivan. For those that might want to take a look at it, is there an Amazon page? And I know this is a Wild Blue Press release. So tell us how they might take a look, more information, website, yeah. Facebook page, etc.
Yeah. There's two places where you could go. If you want to do a little reading of it, see, you can always go to Amazon and you'll find the book there and it'll have a look inside. And then you can just kind of, you know, click on that and you can read some of it. And they always let people do that with, you know, small portions of the book.
Yes.
And you can see all my books there. Or if you want to go to Wild Blue Press, you can also go there and click on my name and they have almost all of my books listed. I write true crime blogs and you can go back. And in fact, you go to Amazon, my blogs are listed down there and you can click on from Amazon on any one of these blogs I've written and it'll take you over to Wild Blue Press. So those are the two locations where you can find out information about me.
I want to thank you very much, Kevin M. Sullivan, Ted Bundy, the Yearly Journal. Thank you so much. You have a great evening and we'll be talking to you soon, I'm sure.
Hey, thanks, Dan. We'll
Thank talk you, next Kevin. Time. Good night.
All right, bye-bye. Good night.